Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today we'll hear a discussion entitled The Healthcare Reform, Obamacare. Our two speakers will be Harris Frankel, assistant professor in the Department of Neurological Sciences at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and president of the Nebraska Health Information Initiative, Incorporated, and Sean McGuire, the founder of E.D. Bellis Healthcare Consulting. They'll talk about how they see the effects of the so-called Affordable Health Care Act. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, July 19, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Willis, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Most of us have heard media and political interpretations of how health care reform will change the medical landscape in our country. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled it legal, but how many of us have taken the time to completely read the reform? This afternoon, we have Dr. Harris Frankel and Sean McGuire to enlighten us on this topic. Dr. Frankel is assistant professor for the Department of Neurological Science at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and president of the Nebraska Health Information Initiative, Incorporated. He chairs the committees on Medicare and the Electronic Health Records Task Force, and is also a member of the Association's Healthcare Reform Task Force. Sean McGuire was a former health policy staff member for the U.S. Senate Finance Committee and has an institutional knowledge of Congress, including an understanding of the politics behind the Affordable Care Act. After leaving Capitol Hill, McGuire served from 2009 to 2011 as a health reform consultant for the University of Nebraska Medical Center's College of Medicine and has offered expertise testimony at the Nebraska Unicameral. We welcome both Dr. Frankel and Sean McGuire today at today's Noon Forum.
Well, thank you very much. We're happy to be here, and thanks for having us. In the interest of full disclosure, there's a couple of comments I need to make. One, I have no formal background in health policy. What I have learned has been all on-the-job training. And second of all, I would be remiss, though I'm currently full-time at the Nebraska Medical Center, I spent nearly 22 years in private practice with one of our guests' husbands as my senior partner, who I really owe the successes I've enjoyed in my career, too, and that's Kaylin Goldner and her husband, Dr. John Goldner. So it's always nice to see familiar faces. And Kaylin, you know how I feel about John, and so wanted to make that clear. In any event, this, as you all know, is a very toxic subject. It has become the penultimate political football inside the Beltway. Unfortunately, it's a topic that is very, very important to us as individuals, to us as a community, to us as a state, and to us as a nation. What happened on June 28th fundamentally may change the practice of medicine in the United States. It's not so much how it will change practice for me as a physician, but I think it has the potential to fundamentally change our delivery system as we know it today. I hope that you don't glean from my presentation whether I'm for the bill or against the bill, or whether I was against the bill and now for the bill. The fact is that the Supreme Court has ruled. They have ruled the Accountable Care Act constitutional. And I think there are good parts in the bill, and I think there's policy that's not so good. And we're going to try to highlight some of those. But first, I'd like to talk about how we got there, talk about the Supreme Court decision, and then we'll talk about some of the major issues that I think confront all of us. To begin, as you know, healthcare reform is a subject that is not new to this era. Healthcare reform was really first addressed in the early 1900s. It has continued through several different administrations to no avail. The first major change in healthcare really came in 1965 with the advent of Medicare and Medicaid. That, in essence, put into play a form of socialized medicine, if you will. The government took the responsibility to guarantee coverage for America's seniors and for a certain subset of challenged individuals, individuals with kidney disease, elderly, nursing home patients, certain children, pregnant women, et cetera, and that's Medicaid. Medicaid is a shared program between the federal government and the states. There are a set of basic rules that states must follow, but states have the ability to alter the program somewhat so long as they keep in place the fundamental rules that have been set forth by the federal government. And for administering the program, there is a shared subsidy that's provided both by the federal government and the states to the individuals. All 50 states currently participate in Medicaid. And as you all know, Medicaid expansion as the means of expanding coverage to the nearly 50 million U.S. citizens who are currently without insurance is a significant piece of the legislation. Really beginning in 2007, following the failures of the Clintons in the early 90s, now President Obama and his campaign made it clear that he wanted health reform to be a prominent part of his campaign and, if elected, a prominent piece of his administrative work. As you all know, what happened in March of 2010, the ACA became law. It was a straight party line vote, and then several challenges to the law soon followed. The major issue was the constitutionality of the individual mandate. If we move forward to the SCOTUS hearings and subsequent ruling on the bill, what we know is there was one issue ahead of determining the constitutionality of the mandate, and that was the Anti-Injunction Act. And what the Anti-Injunction Act stipulated was that, or is that a bill pertaining to taxation and the constitutionality thereof cannot be ruled on until the tax has actually gone into effect and the plaintiffs have paid the tax and then sue for the refund of the tax and hence whether and then can challenge the bill. As you all know, the issue of the individual mandate or the shared responsibility payment, as it is referred to, was deemed a penalty in the bill and by the members of Congress that were trying to shepherd the bill through and not a tax. Because of that title and simply on the basis of the title penalty and not tax, that was fatal to the Anti-Injunction Act, and so the Supreme Court determined that they could in fact hear the challenges that were made by others to uphold or knock down the constitutionality of the bill. Move forward, the first process was to determine is the individual mandate constitutional. And that first challenge came under the Commerce Clause, and it was decided in a vote of 5-4, with Judge Roberts being the dissenting Republican judge, that It was decided that under the Commerce Clause, the individual mandate was not constitutional. It compelled people into commerce, and it was felt by the court that that was an overreach of Congress. However, Judge Roberts, in his decision, deemed that, in fact, this was a tax, and because it was deemed a tax, it was held constitutional under the taxation laws that Congress is able to follow. So the mandate stood. It's interesting that on one hand, because it was called a penalty, the Anti-Injunction Act was not germane. They then determined it to be a tax, and because of that, and under not the Commerce Clause but the taxation rules, that it could be upheld. The second issue of the bill really focused on Medicaid's expansion and could the federal government compel states to expand Medicaid for fear of the penalty of losing all their Medicaid dollars if they chose not to. And that's how the bill was written, that if a state chose not to expand and accept the federal government's money to expand, that they would lose all the federal subsidy that they had received heretofore under the current Medicaid program. The Supreme Court, in a 7-2 decision, determined that that was a far overreach of Congress. They could not compel states to accept Medicaid expansion at the risk of losing the already subsidy dollars they received. and therefore determined that Medicaid expansion, as described in the bill, would be optional for states. And so here we are. Okay, that's what we have. We now have an individual mandate or the shared responsibility payment that stands, and we have a Medicaid expansion piece that has become optional for states. And as you've heard, in our own state, we have not made any decision as to what we're going to do going forward, either relative to insurance exchanges or expansion of the Medicaid program. As you all know, the reasons being is that that the leaders of our state are waiting for the November 6th election because there's a fair belief that if the House maintains its Republican majority and the Senate turns over to the Republicans and there's a Republican leader in the White House, that there's a fair chance that the bill will be repealed. Now, that's very hard to do, but under reconciliation it can be done. But I still think this will be a very, very difficult task if Governor Romney is elected to the White House. That being said, the toxicity of this debate, as you've heard through various media outlets, it continues to date. It's a topic of conversation most everywhere I go, certainly amongst my colleagues at the medical center, amongst my physician colleagues in the community, friends, relatives, even my family talks about it at the dinner table. That being said, I think at this point I'm going to turn it over to Sean and let him make some comments, and then I'll add some additional comments later, and then I think we'll open it up for questions. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Frankel. And I guess I'm going to take a backtrack a little bit, and I'm going to explain how exactly we got here, how we got to the Supreme Court decision, and what it means for you, and then hopefully we'll leave plenty of time for some questions, because that's the favorite part about my job, is answering some of these things that I've been studying for a while. And just to clarify, everybody, if you wanted to know what it looks like, here it is. This is the Affordable Care Act. And I'll pose for a picture really quick so you can see, but I'll throw it down for the thud so you can see. Do it one more time. There you go. The Affordable Care Act passed Congress and was signed by President Obama on March 23rd of 2010. So contrary to a lot of people's opinions prior to the Supreme Court ruling, it is a law, and it's been given a 10-year implementation period and then some. Basically, this legislation is creating what's called a new entitlement program. And the good doctor mentioned Medicaid as an entitlement program. Another one is Medicare, and I see many Medicare-eligible individuals here in the room. So hopefully I can clarify some questions about this program, because there are a lot of changes to it under this legislation, and there's some information that you need to know. The United States spends twice any other industrialized nation on health care. We spend about $7,000 per person, and our outcomes are not up to par. We rank low in preventable mortality, hospital acquired infections, and a lot of things. So to put things in context, Princeton economist Uwe Reinhardt said back in 2009, when they were just beginning to scratch the surface on this thing, where they go, they said, American healthcare reform is like putting a man on the moon. It takes a national effort, and that's what I believe it's ultimately going to take as we look down the road. I think this legislation has some good things. I think there's some other things in it that need to be addressed, and those are some of the things that we try and focus on. The two key problems with the American healthcare system are, one, like I said, costs are too high. A major reason why costs are so high is because of chronic disease, and about 83% of pharmaceutical costs go to chronic disease. So that's an ongoing thing. Chronic means it's an ongoing thing. Acute means it's a one-person thing. My sister hurt her back moving yesterday, and so she went and got some pain medication and muscle relaxers. That's of the 17% of these costs. So individuals with chronic disease are something that we're going to really need to look at going forward, because managing them and keeping them from utilizing the system is one of the best ways we can bend the cost curve. The other problem, because of high costs, is there's a high number of individuals who are uninsured. And that's the crux of this legislation. It's more like health insurance reform than it is health care reform. Now, there's some things in there that change how care is delivered, but the main focus of this law was to get the nearly 50 million people that don't have insurance in America some sort of coverage. And so they do that by two things, three things, actually. One, they mandate everybody does it, but in order to do that, they provide subsidies for individuals who can't afford it. and they create a marketplace called health insurance exchanges. And we'll get into those a little bit later in our question and answer period. But those are something that's in the news here locally because it's a huge strain that's going to be on Lincoln because they're really going to need to figure out what they're going to do with these things, or the federal government will come in and set it up for them. The other thing, and so it's like a three-legged stool, this covered piece, and that's why the Supreme Court upholding the individual mandate was so important, I guess, for the proponents of this legislation, because if you were to take away the mandate that everybody buys insurance, people would not utilize or buy insurance until they got sick. And, of course, taxpayers would still be paying for that bill, so it's not really fair. So from a policy perspective, that's kind of where they were going. The legislative process of this thing is what's really interesting to keep an eye on, because when you hear members of Republican parties talking about repealing this legislation, they're going to have to use a tactic probably that is called reconciliation. And that's how this law was passed. And it is a procedural move that really got some traction in the 80s. And it's a mechanism used to avoid the filibuster of needing 60 votes in the United States Senate, and you only need 51. But the problem is it has to have a direct impact on the federal spending deficit. And so when you see Republicans looking to try to repeal this law, they're going to probably use this mechanism, but it's going to be it'll be very interesting to follow to see which parts they can take away and which parts they cannot. I predicted that this legislation was going to be upheld by the Supreme Court, and I think it's going to be probably implemented unless a transformational change happens in this fall election. And so but because of how the law was passed and through this reconciliation process, the members didn't want to put a lot of these controversial issues on the table because then they would be subject to political attacks in the fall. So a tremendous amount of authority in this legislation is given to the executive branch to write key rules, regulations, and this is going to have an adverse impact on the business community from my analysis, just because of all the requirements that it's going to need for business above 50 employees to keep up with all these ensuing regulations. Let me quantify real quick an example of this, and Dr. Frankel talked about accountable care organizations earlier. An accountable care organization is a system similar to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, or Intermountain Health, and it's kind of a product of this legislation. You're seeing physicians start to organize differently. But an accountable care organization was only 6 pages out of this legislation, and it was about 300 pages of regulations just out of those 6 pages. So there's just going to be an enormous moving target with thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of pages of regulations that business owners, individuals, and healthcare providers are going to have to keep up with. So those are a few things to warm you up. I don't want to take any more time because I want to leave as much time as we can for question and answers, because there's certainly a lot. So thank you.
I want to talk about a couple things and highlight some of what Sean mentioned. First and foremost, as you've heard, the biggest issue is cost. I think arguably if somebody asked you how much of GDP should we spend on defense, your response would be whatever it takes to keep us safe. And we wouldn't argue that point. And I would similarly argue the point that if we had a transparent health system, knew what things cost, that there were significant market forces that could drive this a little differently than happens now, and somebody said, how much of GDP do you think we should spend on health care? Most people would say, whatever gets the biggest bang for the buck and what's the most efficient spend of our healthcare dollar and what can keep the greatest number of our citizens healthy, what can allow us to, when risk is identified, to do the things we need to do to prevent risk from becoming disease. And when we do identify individuals with diseases, allow us to do the things that manage those chronic diseases, which is really where the largest line share of healthcare spending occurs. Statistics suggest that 10 to 20% of individuals account for 60 to 80% of the costs in healthcare. And it is largely individuals with one or more chronic diseases, the biggest being diabetes, hypertension, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, and lung disease. So without question, the biggest target is to do a better job in the longitudinal management of individuals with chronic disease. Prevent unnecessary readmissions to hospitals. That's a huge expense to the system. Is that if we can, in that transitional care piece, when people leave the acute care setting and go to a nursing facility, a skilled facility, or even back home to home care, if we can do a better job at managing their illnesses outside the acute care setting and keep them from going back to the hospital, we can save an incredible amount of money. Can we cut costs and still provide the same number of services? That's tough. And I'm not up here to tell you that I think we need to ration care, because that's not what I'm saying, but I think we have to be more efficient and maybe think a little harder about the how and why we use resources, and make sure that we're using resources efficiently, avoid redundancy in using resources where we can, and where evidence-based medicine is possible, and there are some areas where evidence-based medicine can work, the treatment of community-acquired pneumonia in hospitals, certain protocols for treating congestive heart failure, we should employ those where possible. We, as the really the generators of the cash register in our system, because of the stroke of our pen, the physicians are the one who orders tests, so we have a real responsibility to try to maximize the efficiency and use good discretion when taking care of all of you. That being said, and one of the issues that really isn't discussed in the bill is personal responsibility. If I tell you you're a diabetic, you've got high blood pressure, and you smoke, and you really need to get on top of that stuff, and we'll provide the assistive care personnel to help you do that, okay? Otherwise, you're going to end up in the ICU with a heart attack and stroke. There's got to be some skin in the wheel for the individuals who harbor these diseases, okay? Individuals choose not to do certain things, and I'm all about personal liberties, but it makes it very hard to manage a system and care for individuals who you've outlined exactly what it is they need to do, who choose not to do it, okay? And I think we all have to agree that, that there is a segment of the population that that's who they are, okay? On the flip side, as I kind of alluded to earlier, our healthcare system is one of primarily disease intervention or sick care, okay? We take care of individuals who are ill. Many people don't enter the healthcare system until they've had a heart attack or stroke. I talked about how we can maintain wellness, how we can identify risk and hopefully do things to prevent risk from becoming disease. It requires a complete paradigm shift in the healthcare system we live today. So rather than waiting till people get sick, and rather than putting constraints on primary care physicians who feel they don't have the time to do the things they used to do as primary care physicians, case in point, why do you think these national disease management companies make so much money? Because there's a lot of money to be made in the management of chronic disease. It's what physicians used to do years ago because they felt they could take the time to do it. They felt they were adequately reimbursed for their time. And now, because of reimbursement constraints, and I'm not here to complain about what doctors make, so don't misunderstand me. The fact is, though, primary care physicians who have a large responsibility and want to accept that responsibility to keep you well when they can, the reimbursement pressures on primary care have become such that they don't feel that they can spend the time necessary frequently, and that they have to churn patients through. They hire PAs and nurse practitioners who do an excellent job, okay? But many people, I hear it, it's not my doctor. Or I've heard people say, I've been to the doctor several times, I've never seen the physician, okay? And it has to do with reimbursement pressures, the ability to keep an office open, the fact that expenses on the operating side of a physician practice continue to rise without a compensatory rise in the reimbursement. the incentives in medicine are somewhat perverse right now, and physicians are not incentivized, or other care providers are not really incentivized to do the things that we ought to be doing in many circumstances. So you're going to hear going forward changes in reimbursement models. You're going to hear things like value-based purchasing, Medicare, Medicaid, looking for services from the provider community, physicians, hospitals, that they feel are value-based. They're determined on patient outcomes, quality improvements in the delivery of care, and ultimately the cost of care provided to all of us. You're going to hear about integrated delivery systems where, as Sean mentioned, the Mayo Clinic, Geisinger Health, Intermountain Health, the Cleveland Clinic. You're going to hear about integrated delivery systems taking care of populations of patients. So it's not just the individual patient per se, but it's many, many, many individuals who create a population of patients that become under the care of one or a group of physicians who, in essence, will be capitated to keep these people well, to manage the chronic disease, and to eliminate a lot of the waste that is currently present in the healthcare system. Again, the individuals with chronic disease is where the biggest bang for the buck is in cost savings. And I would argue that if we accomplish the things that we all talk about that are needing to be done, the discussion about healthcare spending in this country being X percentage of GDP would probably not be an issue. I think there's plenty of money in the system to do the things we need to do because there's plenty of waste in the system. And we can talk about, as I said before, unavoidable admissions to hospitals, errors in medicine. You know, there's 90 to 100,000 individuals that suffer adverse consequences with significant financial impact to the system because of avoidable errors, inappropriate medications, inappropriate doses, et cetera. We hear talk of other things. We hear talk of the insurance industry and the exorbitant margins they make. We hear talk of medical liability reform. Yes, defensive medicine is a problem in this country. Is it the biggest problem? It's not the biggest problem. One of the things that didn't get talked about in the whole discussion of the bill was a law that's been on the books since President Reagan was in office, which is called EMTALA. That's the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. And basically what that says, and let me put this in the context of the bill that is coverage for U.S. citizens and legal aliens or legal immigrants. EMTALA says that if you present to an emergency room, the providers in that emergency room have to assess you and treat you and determine that you are stable before a disposition of your case can be made. And it doesn't matter if you're from Mars, Venus, wherever. They have to see you. Now, there's a little thing that a lot of people don't know about that doesn't get used, and that are you can employ what are called EMTALA-certified nurses. There is a mechanism to triage patients before they walk through the emergency room doors. The problem is, because of the fear of medical liability and lawsuits, that health systems are not using these certified nurses to do the triage work that I think would be hugely beneficial, eliminate those people who truly don't have emergent conditions, and get them into either urgent care centers, ambulatory care clinics, or just back to their primary care office. There are a whole host of other things we could do as physicians to increase access without one law. Why should a working parent have to leave their job to take a child to the doctor's office if it's not an emergent condition? Okay, we could do a better job at keeping our doors open later. Okay, my colleagues don't necessarily want to do that, but it makes a whole lot of sense if a primary care office, they had a group of six or seven doctors who decide to work in shifts, or PAs and nurse practitioners who would work in shifts and keep those doors open a little longer so that the mom or dad who's working that really can't afford to take time off work, if they had a kid that needed to be seen, they could take them at 6 or 7 o'clock at night to the doctor's office and not to the emergency room. And that happens. So there are a lot of nuances in our healthcare delivery system today that don't require any legislation that we could do that would make access a lot better. And I'll conclude these remarks by saying that, as Sean pointed out, the bill really addresses coverage. It addresses increasing coverage to the near 50 million Americans who are not covered. The bill aims to cover an additional 30 million. There's a fallacy that these 30 million aren't utilizing health care services now. Most of them are. And we're seeing them, and you are all paying the hidden tax to cover them. Okay? So there's cost shifting that takes place to take care of the indigent and the underinsured. Coverage only guarantees coverage. It doesn't guarantee personal responsibility, and it doesn't guarantee appropriate access to the system. So just because you're covered may not necessarily mean that you won't choose to use the emergency room as your place of access. So we need to do a better job with access. Coverage, I think, certainly has its merits. It, too, has its hidden costs. And I think because of the mandate and the penalties or tax, if you will, that are present, which are not very punitive, I think that you'll see a combination of things. I think you're going to see a fall away from employer-based health insurance because many companies will choose to pay the penalty because it's much cheaper than the premiums. And I think you'll see many individuals choose not to purchase insurance until they get sick because even for them, the penalty is not significant. The last comment I'll make is in today's economy and today's society where we have over 8% unemployment, there are going to be people that can't afford premiums. It will increase the number of individuals eligible under the Medicaid expansion piece where states implement that to receive full subsidy for their coverage. So there's a lot of moving parts to this. I think we're going to see a lot of dollars necessary that don't that weren't readily evident when the initial conversations took place. And I don't think we've seen the finished product yet. I hope there's will on the Hill to do the right thing, keep the pieces in the bill that are good, guarantee issue, children on their parents' policy till 26, the increased coverage for children, no lifetime caps, things that make sense, the elimination of pre-existing conditions, and fix the pieces of the bill that need to be fixed because we have a problem with or without the bill. Okay, I think the Supreme Court's decision is nothing more than a red-letter day in history because of the ruling. We would have had the problem if they voted it down. Okay, it is an issue we have to address. It needs to be taken very seriously. And I hope there is the will in Washington to eliminate the toxicity that exists over the bill and move forward and do the right thing.
Okay, we've got a lot of good questions, and I'll try to get to them, as many of them as I possibly can. The first one here is, I understand some doctors state that they will withdraw from the system as it stands. How true is this?
That's a very good question, and I can tell you I have several colleagues that even as far back as a couple years ago, closed their door to Medicare and Medicaid patients. And the reasoning has been is that because the reimbursements to see those patients fall substantially short of what commercial payers pay, and because of the rising cost of their practices, they made a decision not to see any new Medicare or Medicaid patients at that time. I think that is a possibility that will become more problematic going forward. I would like to think that that's not the decision my colleagues choose to make. I think we all have a responsibility to see anybody. That's the oath we took. That may sound a little idealistic, but that's what I believe, and that's what my practice did. I'd certainly do it at the university, but I think that is a potential problem going forward.
Next question. What are changes to Medicare and Medicaid? I know whoever wants to take that question.
I can do Medicare. You want to do Medicaid?
Sure. Okay.
Medicare, I'll address that first. Medicare has four parts, Medicare Part A, which pays for an individual's hospital insurance, Medicare Part B, which basically pays for physician and other outpatient services, Part C, which is a program created in 2003 called Medicare Advantage, and it was created in the Medicare Prescription Drug Bill, and it's aimed to get private industry plans administering Medicare, and then finally is Medicare Part D, which is the prescription drug benefit. So I'm going to just go through the impacts of each one. Part A, hospitals are subject to reduced cuts in what's called disproportional share, which is It's basically subsidies they get for seeing patients that cannot pay. So hospitals like UNMC and Creighton rely on those dollars because they see a lot of people without insurance. Part B is pretty much – there's a few things in there, but from what I recall, it's not really that impacted. Part C has huge cuts in Part C, and it basically is in subsidies that went to drug companies to incentivize them to administer these plans. And Medicare Advantage is it's kind of important for rural states, especially states like Nebraska and others in the West, because there's not much many plans out there for people to go. So certain seniors liked Medicare Advantage, and that's weakened under this legislation. Part D is actually strengthened because it provides some relief for senior citizens who find themselves in the donut hole, and that's a really problematic thing. If you spend more than, I think it's $2,500, you're in a coverage gap for until you hit your catastrophic limit. And the legislation provided a rebate for seniors in the donut hole the first year, and then that slowly closes over time.
So real quickly, Medicaid, as we alluded to earlier, and as I'm sure many of you know, Medicaid expansion was the tool that was that is in the law to increase coverage. So Medicaid itself becomes, if you will, the default for those who cannot afford to either buy individual policies or family policies in the marketplace, be it direct contracting with payers or through the insurance exchanges, or who don't have employer-sponsored benefits at work. Medicaid aims to provide for nothing those who fall below the 133% of the federal poverty line. So for a family of four, that total is $25,000 roughly, and then provide subsidies up to four times that level or so, which is about $88,000 for a family of four. So it really is the vehicle by which the law suggests to expand coverage. It invites into the program some individuals who previously were not covered under existing Medicaid laws. As I said, there are some children who now achieve benefits. There are some other eligibles other than elderly who become eligible under the plan. It would increase the state's expenses to the largest line item budget for many states and certainly for the state of Nebraska. That being said, the federal government had agreed to pay 100% of the extra costs the first 3 years, and then over the next several years reduce their contribution such that in the end the federal government would pay 90%, states would have to pick up 10% of that added cost.
Will the law actually result in keeping health care costs from continuing to skyrocket?
I don't believe so. And evidence has come out. Basically, health care costs have, since about 1986, Dr. Frankel mentioned EMTALA, which was that legislation saying that everybody can basically be seen at emergency rooms. And that's kind of when you go back and look at the data, that's when you see the costs really start to skyrocket. And many people believe that costs will actually be exacerbated under this legislation because you're adding a sicker population to the rolls, and still has a lot of flaws in the system. The Congressional Budget Office came out and predicted that the legislation would cost, when it was passed, they thought it was going to cost about, you know, $900 billion over 10 years. And that sense has basically doubled in their latest estimations. And just to give you a comparable example, Medicare was predicted to cost, I don't know, maybe between $3 and $5 billion, I believe, when it was passed, and then they thought it would be about 1990. They thought it was going to be, of course, it was passed in 65. They thought it was going to cost about $90 billion, and of course, in 2012, it costs about $400 billion each year. So it's really hard to forecast how much this stuff is going to cost over time, but it's certainly make some attempts to control cost. Whether that will actually play out still remains to be seen, unfortunately.
Next question. if the health care reform gets implemented, which it looks like it's going to, will we be paying more for our health insurance?
Well, let me say something. It's been parts of the bill have already been implemented. Some of the things I mentioned before. Children who can't stay on their parents' policy till they're age 26. There's a pool that's been created for high-risk individuals who heretofore have not been able to get coverage because of the pre-existing condition clauses that the majority of payers have. So there are several pieces of the bill that have been implemented. The meat of the bill really kicks in 2014. Do I think health insurance is going to get cheaper? I don't know. If we talk in just not accounting for inflation or other factors that put price pressures on things, I don't think so. The healthcare system does not follow standard economic principles. It is not supply and demand. So the more demand there is, the cheaper things get. An MRI unit costs the same whether the facility does one or 100. That doesn't change. It's hard for me to imagine that if the demand for services goes up as a function of more people being covered, it's hard to imagine how the absolute cost of our delivery system will get less. Do I think the rate at which the healthcare spend is currently, do I think we can bend that cost curve as all the political heads talk? I think that's a hard question to answer as well. I'm not sure we can. It is awfully hard, in my opinion, to control cost without limiting services. I would reference a book that I think is a good read for everybody, and it's called Overtreated, and it's written by a gal, Shannon Brownlee. And I think that will give you an idea as to what the real issues about cost in our delivery system are. So I'm not optimistic that we're going to be able to lessen premiums for individuals or families. The talk is that, well, if we eliminate the hidden tax by providing coverage to others who will not be paying their fair share, that the cost to you and I as an individual should be less. I'm skeptical about that, and I'm not willing to opine with any certainty that that will happen.
Can I add really quick?
Yeah.
The data that I've seen indicates that premiums are going to rise by about 7.5% for at least the next 3 years. So when you take a $500 policy, that's some serious money each year coming out of pocket. And because of that, you're seeing workers, and this has been going on for a while now, workers are not seeing wage increases because the cost of doing business is going up, particularly because of healthcare costs. And so their employers are basically choosing to cover their insurance instead of give them wages. And the other thing, too, I want to point out really quick is when you add new people to the system, this may have some adverse impacts on workforce issues because we have a healthcare population, provider population that's aging, and with all these new people coming into the system, there may not be enough people to work to handle this influx, and that was kind of the problem that we have seen in Massachusetts.
Let me make one more comment real quick about the hidden costs in our delivery system. In Nebraska, for instance, we spend about, what's the number, $8 billion in healthcare?
$8 billion.
Okay. Of that $8 billion,
$8 billion in chronic disease,
Chronic disease alone. So of that, $2.5 or so billion is in the actual healthcare cost for those individuals. But it's the $5.5 billion in lost productivity because these individuals are either in the workforce only part time or not at all that creates a real drag on the rest of us. And when I say us as a society, is that lost productivity hurts the economy of our country. It impairs the ability for our businesses to compete in a global economy. And if you look back 25, 30 years, there's a nice graph that's published that many people use. If you look at individual workers' wage increases over the last 30 years and you look at the increase in healthcare costs during that same period of time, that increase in wages does nothing more than support the rising cost of healthcare in our country. So in essence, nobody's making any more today than they did 30 years ago, which I think is a real problem, okay? people work hard, and though they get wage increases, that's only supporting a cost of a rising healthcare system. And so margins on companies that allow them to compete in our global economy are just hindered significantly.
Next question. How is Governor Romney's health care reform program, when he was governor of Massachusetts, different than President Obama's health care act?
Go ahead.
Well, you obviously hear probably people on the news, they call it Romney Care instead of Obamacare. The principles are very similar. So the Massachusetts, it's called the Massachusetts Connector, and I believe it was passed when, 2006 or so? Mm-hmm. I don't know. And it creates health insurance exchanges. It has an individual mandate. It provides some subsidies to do it, and they've been able to achieve near universal coverage, but they've had some problems with workforce questions, like I indicated earlier, and they haven't really been able to control costs. So in essence, they're similar in that respect. However, that bill was only like 50 pages long. This one's 2,700 pages long. This legislation is basically the Christmas tree of health policy bills, because there are things in there that people have been working on for 30 years now that they finally had the opportunity to throw it in. So you're going to see a lot of it. My biggest comment on the Romney plan versus this plan is that legislation was done at the state level, and I think that's much easier because you have a better understanding of your population, you can have the community more involved, and I think that's a better solution than trying to take something and make it work for the entire United States of America, which is impossible because our healthcare spending varies so much by region. A person on Medicare in Miami costs twice as much to cover as a person in Minneapolis, so you can kind of see it doesn't really work to try and make one thing for everybody.
Okay. Next question. I will soon be going on Medicare. How does health care reform affect me?
Well, hopefully it won't. And I don't see Medicare as a program for our seniors going away. I'll give you a simple rule of thumb from D.C. When my colleagues ask, why are my Medicare fees being cut? And the answer is simple. That's because ARP is a bigger lobby than the AMA. I mean, that's, you know, unfortunately, deal making is the currency of politics in D.C. I will say this, though, and I think something that you need to be aware of is that there are projected to be $550 billion worth of cuts in Medicare to help fund the bill and the new programs in the bill. And those cuts are coming to providers, so hospitals, physicians, and other services. And so I think in the context of where the projected spending cuts are to fund programs within the bill, expansion of coverage, et cetera, I think you have to ask yourself an honest question. Even though we hear that our benefits won't be affected, I think the real question is will and how they be affected. I think there is a chance they could be affected. You would like to think not, but my feeling is it's probably unavoidable. The question becomes, as we mentioned earlier, does that change affect access to America's seniors? I guess time will tell. I'm a bit pessimistic that things will stay the same.
Just to add, a bunch of new preventive measures are added for Medicare individuals, screenings, immunizations, stuff like that, which is great. And prevention is very important. But at the end of the day, somebody's got to pay for it. And so the physician that has to see them, they have to take more time out of their day to do this. And I just think that it could potentially lead to more waiting times, potentially. Dr. Frank, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, the concept of waiting times and lines for care, you know, that results from systems that budgetize their healthcare system. It becomes a line item in the budget that has to remain budget neutral. So if you're approaching the peak of spending relative to the budget, services get cut. I mean, and that's what happens in many of these other countries, is that because healthcare is a budget item, okay, it's driven from the top down as it relates to spending. And so allocation for services is solely based on the budget allowance for either that community, that state, the country, whatever. That's where I think a lot of the lines are created. Do I think we're going to have lines in this country of people waiting to get care? I would like to think not. Okay. Are there some elective procedures that might not get done because people rethink the necessity, the medical necessity of doing elective procedures? I think that's a discussion we have to have. But when you hear people, I think, throwing out that you're going to be standing in line to get your hip replaced if it's medically necessary, or you're going to be standing in line to see a physician because you've got a serious illness that needs addressing now and not later, I really hope that doesn't happen. And maybe I'm just too idealistic to believe the what I'm talking about. But I would like to think that we're better than that, and that we can work together to resolve the issues that will prevent those sorts of situations. And I think we can.
Okay, thank you. Next question is regarding preventative care. Are there provisions in the Health Care Act providing, and they say they have question, mandatory for annual physicals, and then for persons beyond a certain age?
You may take
that.
Oh, go ahead.
Yes, there is. Again, I touched on it on Medicare, but it also, in what's called the insurance market reforms, it's the early part of the legislation, they basically say that it's called essential benefits. And so what this is the government basically says, you know, new going forward, some existing plans, if they haven't changed since March 23rd, 2010, would be grandfathered. But going forward, all new plans must cover certain preventive benefits, again, at no copay to the individual. So there is stuff like that for prevention. But again, my point, somebody's got to pay for this stuff. And I think we are going to collectively in higher taxes.
You know, I think that brings up an interesting point as well, is that many of us may have plans that don't meet all 10 essential benefits that are being required by the new law. So by virtue of the fact that we would be held accountable, no pun intended, to have a policy that meets all 10 essential benefits that we may not currently have with our existing health plans, that by itself may make your premium more than what you pay today. It also brings in the question you've heard in the news about religious organizations who don't feel they should be paying for services that are not part of their religious tenet. I can tell you right now that I have a good friend. She's an OB-GYN doc at Bergen Mercy Hospital. And if she has a woman who she delivers, and that woman would like to have a tubal ligation at the same time of her delivery, which is a common practice, they're under anesthesia once, the tubal ligation is done. She now cannot do that at Bergen. It requires a second admission for that woman at a different institution, she told me. And so I think you're going to be hearing more about groups looking for exemptions as they relate to some of these essential benefits. Again, this is a contraceptive issue. There are some added benefits that have that are required that I think does make it a little more opportune for the consumer to have access to these services. But again, if you don't have them now, and you may not need them, you know, I personally don't need a policy that covers birth control. Okay, but you know, so you may, just by virtue of what you have now to what you're going to, you may pay a higher premium. So.
I think this is going to probably be our last question due to time, and believe me, there's a lot more questions to go, but due to time constraints, what elements of the bill can states customize or opt out of? And this is a two-part question. What impact would those choices have on other states' residents and the system as a whole?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question, because now that the Medicaid expansion piece has been made optional, I think that calls into question what that will do not only to states who choose not to expand their Medicaid coverage, but those who do. If you look at the Medicaid population, the lion's share of Medicaid population is very mobile. Okay, they tend to be, in large part, many young people who are uninsured, maybe out of the workforce, whatever, children, et cetera. It's a, by and large part, except for elderly and some of the dual eligibles, it's a fairly mobile population, okay? What I see potentially happening is those states who will provide expansion under the new law, you may see migration of individuals from state to states, flooding those states that offer the expansion piece from states that currently don't. The federal government gives states, as I said earlier, some leeway as to how to customize their Medicaid programs so long as they maintain the essential fundamentals that the federal government puts forth. There are things called waivers that states can use to do things that are innovative. And I think, you know, Nebraska historically has not taken advantage of the waiver process. I think we as a state have an opportunity to be innovative. We have a long history of public-private partnerships. This state has done a tremendous amount given the relatively small population we have. I think Nebraska has a real opportunity to move forward, to be innovative in how we deal with the 11% uninsured in our state. And it disappoints me that our governor, who I consider a friend, has taken the position he's taken. It's a very political position. I think it's the wrong position. I would like to see the legislature convening task force to address innovative thinking in how we move Medicaid forward, how we address the 11% uninsured in the state, plus the additional underinsured going forward. So I think there is opportunities to do things, even if you don't choose to follow the course of Medicaid expansion as it's outlined in the law.
Just one more point on Medicaid, and then also the other issue is health insurance exchanges, which is going to be the other thing. One point about Medicaid is it's the number one line item in the state budget. So when you add new people onto that program, it's going to be much more expensive. And when we can't afford it and we have an administration that doesn't want to raise taxes, and I think most Nebraskans agree that they don't want to do that, that means that there's less money available for higher education and other programs, and that's something that we need to take a look at. Finally, the other issue is health insurance exchanges, and this is another issue that we touched on as far as health exchanges like Orbitz.com or Travelocity or a place that you would go book a hotel or a plane flight, except for it's with health insurance. But there's a tremendous amount of overhead and stuff that's going to need to be set up at each state level. And that's something that's a challenge that this state faces also, because federal funding is available, but there are deadlines, and those are approaching very soon. So I'd like to see them look at that issue as well. I think the state could seriously take a step towards covering everybody. We have two academic medical centers here in Nebraska. Of the uninsured here in the state, about half of them would be eligible for the Medicaid expansion, and then the other half would be private insurance. So I think innovative solutions going forward would be desirable for our state policymakers to pursue.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank Dr. Harris Frankel and Sean McGuire for taking time out of their busy schedules to participate in today's forum. Thank you.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. We've heard a discussion entitled The Healthcare Reform, Obamacare. Our two speakers have been Harris Frankel, Assistant Professor in the Department of Neurological Sciences at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and President of the Nebraska Health Information Initiative, Incorporated, and Sean McGuire, the founder of E.D. Bellis Healthcare Consulting. They've talked about how they see the effects of the so-called Affordable Health Care Act. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, July 19th, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.